Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Earlier this year, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf said the state is studying the issue of whether marijuana should be legalized for recreational purposes. Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman then went on an unprecedented tour of all 67 of the state's counties to hear the opinions of Pennsylvanians. What did he hear, and how will those opinions be taken into consideration? Joining us on the first segment of today's program is Pennsylvania Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman. Governor Fetterman, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. Please call me John, and let's get into it.
Well, let's let our listeners get in on it as well. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Are you still taking opinions from Pennsylvanians?
Well, people stop me all the time. I mean, really? Not a day goes by where, in fact, just yesterday, we had some visitors in my office, and he said, hey, I couldn't make the meeting, but I wanted to share my thoughts on it. But technically, the state website, the last day was May 31st, so very recent, just up till a couple days ago.
All right. So you did make 70 stops in all 67 counties.
Correct.
Across the state. What were your observations?
Well, there are a lot of observations. One, that Pennsylvanians genuinely appreciated the opportunity to hear directly and interact with their elected officials. And that Pennsylvanians are a civil, courteous people. And in those 70 meetings, I've never once had to demand civility from an audience. It was always offered and given, and we had 70 productive conversations. And I think that's a tribute to the people of Pennsylvania and the fact that civil discourse between those that don't necessarily agree on every issue is more critical today than ever, I think, with social media, where it's easy to flame someone or be cruel or cutting. It's much different when you're in person and you can say, you know, and some of the most powerful moments occurred when somebody said, you know, I came to this meeting thinking one thing, and after hearing X, Y, and Z, I'm changing my views on things, and this kind of thoughtful analysis that occurs.
Did you expect that there would be some people who may get a little bit overzealous?
Sure.
The reason I ask that question is because just what you described on social media and the atmosphere that we live in today, you would think that with 70 different meetings, there would be at least one person who would get out of hand.
Yeah, the odds are.
Right,
And I didn't necessarily expect it, but it wouldn't have surprised me necessarily. But like I said, just in 70 meetings, it's not unthinkable to say, wow, something might, but it never happened. And people always, with rare exceptions, fully respected the other views. They may not have agreed with the other person's views, but they heard them. And I think that's was a useful, constructive exercise.
All right, so let's talk about those views. That's what most people probably care about. What did you hear? Where did Pennsylvanians come down on legalization?
Well, broadly, I would say somewhere around 65 to maybe 70% of Pennsylvanians are for recreational marijuana in some way, shape, or form. One of the major things that emerged during that also was a virtual unanimous appreciation and affection for our medical marijuana program. As you probably know, how contentious it was and how, and how hard it was to get to that point. And now, no matter where they are on the spectrum for recreationally, it's, well, I'm not talking about medical. Medical's great. The one issue about medical that did come up over and over again is the expense for people on fixed income
or
on disability. And it's not covered by insurance because it's a Schedule I drug. And that leads me into the next one of the key distinctions that emerged is that, again, with the exception of two or three, four people across the whole state, did we encounter somebody that doesn't believe that the Schedule I classification needs to change?
When you're, just for context purposes, what you're talking about is the federal government has marijuana as a Schedule I. And
That creates all kinds of tangential issues, whether it's Second Amendment issues, whether it's banking issues, whether it's, can an insurance company cover that as part of a reimbursement? Our veterans, particularly, that's some of the most wrenching and difficult testimony was from our veterans saying that I am here, you know, not just at the meeting, I am here living, but for cannabis. And they would express frustration that the VA would give them whatever pills, but they wouldn't give them the one thing that just makes them feel normal. That was their choice of words. Not great, not everything's going to be okay, but it places them in a position where they can begin to confront the trauma and some of the emotional injury that they sustained. And they said, I fought and risked my life and safety for this country that considers me a criminal by using a plant. They specifically said the word plant, that I need to feel normal. And I don't believe that's right.
Mm-hmm. Going to all 67 counties to hear Pennsylvanians on a single issue, especially for someone not campaigning for an office, that's almost unprecedented. I don't know whether it's happened before in this state. But those who passionately support legalization would seem to be more motivated to show up. No. So I guess what I have to question is the numbers that you heard that up from over half to maybe two-thirds support. It's not scientific.
Well, it's not exactingly scientific, and many polls aren't exactingly scientific. We have a sample size of over 30,000 comments. We have a sample size of thousands of people coming out. And anecdotally, I disagree with the assumption that those that are more motivated for legalization are the only ones that come. It's a divisive issue. There's plenty of motivation, especially in red counties, conservative ones, where people, you know, are strongly opposed to it. So they, of course, are going to come out to share opposition. And we were saying consistently that even in these very red, traditionally conservative counties like Somerset or Bedford, we are seeing a slight majority of individuals that are for it, you know, 50-50, you know, 55-45, very tight. And a poll came out on 420 to commemorate 420 by CBS News. And they found that 56% of Republicans support it. And the Cato Institute just released a strong position on it. Grover Norquist released and supports ending prohibition. And these aren't, you know, touchy-feely, you know, Jeff Spicoli types that are whatever. they are very much in the conservative wheelhouse firmly. And there's also a strong libertarian streak within the Republican Party that's like, the government has no right telling me what I can and can't do in my home as long as it's not hurting anybody else. So our numbers matched up the polling numbers, and we were discovering this before any of those polls kind of came out. Mm-hmm. So I feel very confident. Is it exactly scientific? Well, of course not. But it conforms with and observationally every poll that I've ever seen on it.
I think that may be the first Fast Times at Ridgemont High reference on Sparta.
Well, I would get joked on that, where it's like, this is John Fetterman's Vans, you know, Reefer Madness tour, or all this other stuff, and you know, you have to laugh at it, but at the end of the day, it's a serious public policy issue, and it's one that I was honored to go around to every 67 county and have this conversation.
I'm curious, when you said that, I just want to make sure, I want to clarify here, you said that even in those red counties, most conservative counties, that there was majority. Were there any counties where, when you took a poll, mm-hmm. that it came out against?
There was. One specifically that jumps out at me was Wyoming County. And they definitely, there was individuals there that you felt that they organized. And Jefferson County had a slight majority opposed. And that was because one of the local state reps, Chris Dush, had organized and brought people in to make sure that they came to testify, which again is fine. You know, are you a Pennsylvania voter? Then we want to hear from you. Mm-hmm. But we had a very strict set of rules. The only people that were specifically invited were local electeds. I would call them personally, and they were encouraged to share their views, whatever they were, and we used the same mechanism. I would have college students upset with me saying, you didn't advertise on this on campus. We could add more people. I'm like, you're right, we didn't, because we didn't want to be accused of saying, hey, college students, come out and pack the room. We had one uniform announcement policy that said, here's when we're coming, here's how long we'll be there, and it's open to anyone and everyone. And we maintain that through all 70 stops.
You will file a report with Governor Wolf on this. Generally, what will it say?
I think it'll say a lot of the broad conclusions. What a majority of people in Pennsylvania we heard from is that they support legalized recreational cannabis. They want it grown on Pennsylvania farms. They want it creating Pennsylvania jobs. They want it accessed through a point that does not have a profit motive, that it does not encourage and or market specifically to younger populations or individuals below a certain age. Not one person stood up and said the legal age would be below 21. And there was also a lot of concern for edibles. And a lot of people believe that the ideal location for such a thing, even those that were for and against recreationally, would be some kind of a state store-like system where there's no financial incentive and it's taxed. And not one person said, well, I'll just throw it into the general fund and it'll all work out. They want it very specifically restricted to one or two things. You know, one of the recurring lines was pot for potholes or property tax relief. No one wants it to just kind of go down the black hole of the general fund and no one will know exactly what it goes for.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, Canada's Consul General will be here talking about trade between the U.S., Pennsylvania, and Canada. Also coming up in future shows, coming up next Monday, books to read this summer, whether you're on the beach, on vacation, however you're relaxing, books that you may want to read. Also, we'll be looking at family leave. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. Today, we're talking with Pennsylvania's Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman about the tour that he recently completed of all 67 Pennsylvania counties, getting the opinions of Pennsylvanians on the legalization of marijuana for recreational purposes. 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call if you'd like to weigh in. On Facebook, we are at on Twitter, we are at WITF. And also, if you'd like to send a comment via email, you can send it to smarttalk@witf.org. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's go to Tricia in Chambersburg. Tricia, you're on the air.
I lived in Colorado Springs, and I know just from what I read in the Gazette and different things that they had some issues with, and the stats they reported were about K through 12 and the increase in drug use for kids. They also had about fatal car crashes. The homeless was debatable, but they also said they had an issue with getting people to be able to do work because they couldn't pass the drug test for people that were roofers or construction, driving forklifts, CDL, you know, license where they had to drive and pass drug tests. And I'm aware of, you know, what they say about how long something's in your system and all that. But I do know the governor there had mentioned some of the issues and the problems that they were having with these different points. So I'm just wondering if you looked at other states and actually compared and looked at these issues and how you're going to handle that.
Tricia, thank you very much for your questions and your comment. She brought up a lot there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But let's start with, I know you've looked at Colorado. Have you looked at other states?
Well, we haven't done a deep dive, sent people there, because that would be disingenuous, because we really are just at a point where we wanted to hear where Pennsylvania was at with it. And, you know, the two commitments that I made to the people of Pennsylvania was that we were going to go to every county and we were going to hear and invite everybody who has an opinion to speak. And we're going to detail those findings in a report. And we, of course, did the first part. And I know the second part is going to be realized. We heard from a lot of folks that lamented the CDL paradox, where you could have taken in cannabis a week ago and you'd get flagged in a drug test a week later, and because there's a zero tolerance. And that is an issue caused by, one, that zero tolerance and the federal classification. If the federal government would reclassify cannabis from Schedule One. That would remove an enormous number of barriers for states confronting legalizing cannabis. That creates a major snag for a lot of folks.
Let me ask this. If Pennsylvania, and this is a long way down the road, I think everyone would agree, but if Pennsylvania was to legalize marijuana for recreational purposes today, since the federal government still has it as a Class 1 narcotic, would those drug tests, would they still, employees still take those drug tests, and if you fail, you could be gone?
We would hear from people that are using it legally, medically, technically, and saying, or I can't use it because of my job. If I have a dirty test, I lose my job. And you know what it does? It forces me to take opiates for my pain or for my issue. What we heard over and over again is that cannabis is a gateway drug away from opioid use. And statistics have emerged. In fact, the Cato Institute and Grover Norquist were the ones promoting these studies where it's like where this exists, opioid abuse rates and overdose are lower. So a lot of people, particularly veterans, see it as a gateway drug, a gateway away from opioids.
But you do know that there are a lot of people, Pennsylvania District Attorneys Association, for one, sees it as a gateway in the traditional sense, that it does lead to other drug use.
Absolutely. And we took their views into consideration. I met with statewide sheriff's associations and heard their views. So, I mean, that's the thing. I wasn't a carnival barker for legalizing marijuana. I was a facilitator and I was a moderator and gave the same amount of time, gave the same level of deference and acknowledgement for either view and the undecideds as well too. This was about having a true conversation, and we, no matter what county we went to, we never got like this overwhelming, like, you know, over our dead bodies. This happens. It was again civil and thoughtful, and these rooms were all, no matter how conservative the county, there's a basic line of support there. And again, my thoughts with those more conservative traditional types are that libertarians, they don't like the government interfering, how it affects their Second Amendment rights. And I think probably most transformative was the effect that medical marijuana has had, where people are seeing relatives, elderly, young children getting all kinds of enormous benefits from this. And it's like, well, wait a minute, maybe I need to rethink this one a little bit. And people clamoring for better access. I can't find a doctor in rural America that will prescribe this for me. I have to drive an hour and a half to the dispensary in Bethlehem. A lot of that, you know, and I think that's changing the hearts and minds of people in Pennsylvania on cannabis. And it was a remarkable sea change in the public views of medical cannabis contentious to medical cannabis beloved, just essentially 2 short years later.
Let's take a call from Jim in Enola. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott.
Hi, Jim.
I'm glad that you're speaking to the Lieutenant Governor about this point, and I support the efforts that he's undertaken. I think that the Lieutenant Governor would agree that the major problem we have is not at the state level, it's at the federal level. Because marijuana is a Schedule One drug, which basically means that it's treated the same as heroin and cocaine, have you. I think that there ought to be a consensus in Congress, even though that's hard to come up with, that regardless of whether you support legalization, it is ridiculous to have marijuana continue to be a Schedule One drug. It seems to me that we ought to push the entire Pennsylvania delegation, Republicans and Democrats, to come out in favor of a bill that would change marijuana from being a Schedule One drug. And I'd like to know what the Lieutenant Governor thinks about that.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call.
What I can say is that we encountered literally 2, 3, maybe 4 people that said that classification makes sense in their mind and they wouldn't want it to change. You know, even the most ardent, I'm not ready for that. Now, no one believes that it belongs in the same category. It's much more appropriate in the basket of alcohol or tobacco and things of that nature. And a reclassification would, in my opinion, create, again, a sea change of cannabis across. I mean, remember, it wasn't that long ago that hemp was considered illegal. And now you can, now I read Ben and Jerry's wants to put, you know, hemp oil in ice cream now, and you can go buy it at Sheetz, and people are getting a lot of great results. And all it took was one change in the federal law, like, and here you have this. Nobody genuinely believes that it belongs on Schedule One, at least that I've encountered.
But the reality is, the administration in Washington right now, I mean, the former attorney general, I haven't heard much from William Barr. He's been kind of occupied with some other things here lately. the former attorney general, came right out and said that the feds considered cracking down on states that did this.
Yeah, definitely. It's we live in a divisive time, but I have to say, and I would say to any Republican colleague of mine in the House or Senate, I would say that a majority of your constituents support this and aren't scared of this. To be open-minded to having that conversation and seeing what things are really about. And you don't have to be pro. Like you threw out the scenario, it could be legal tomorrow. Like if it were legal tomorrow, I wouldn't run out and binge on it or partake any more than I'm going to, after this interview, go hit up the state store and guzzle a bottle of Jack Daniels. It's simply access to a pure, safe product where individuals don't have cocaine or heroin or other drugs saying, hey, I don't have any marijuana. You don't know where it came from. You don't know what's in it, but, you know, here you go.
You brought up another point, though, that I'm sure that you heard. I know there's nothing I could bring up here that you didn't hear on this tour, but that is one of the things that the DA's Association has brought up, that today's marijuana is not the marijuana of, say, 10 or 20 years ago, that it is much stronger, and sometimes you don't know what it's laced with.
Under the current situation, you don't know what it's laced with. You don't know what it was grown in. You don't know where it was grown. You don't know what pesticides and what other kind of toxins are. When it's legal and regulated, you know exactly what you're getting. Pennsylvania's medical cannabis is the purest and most tested of any across the states, and it's considered the gold standard. And that's one of the reasons I suspect that it's been as wildly successful as it has been. So to anyone that understandably is concerned about the purity of the marijuana that's out there now, I think that's a reasonable concern. And the proponents that I've heard from want to take that uncertainty away. And I heard time and time again, and I would say that, you know, as the father of three young children, when that time comes to have that conversation with them, I would say, I don't want you absolutely touching cannabis, you know, certainly not before, you know, age 21. But if they did, I would want it to come from a safe, pure, regulated, you know, access point where they aren't in direct contact with a criminal element who might have other harder drugs, who has an incentive to sell them other harder drugs, and you don't know what's in that. And I would say that as a parent, you know, I don't want you doing it, but if you do, you know, this is what I would want compared to, you know, rolling the dice, you know, buying it off some street corner.
Republican leadership has said in so many words, this isn't going anywhere legislatively. But there are Republicans who will admit, probably most will admit, the day will come in Pennsylvania when cannabis is legal for recreational purposes. You talked about college campuses earlier. I think there may be a number of, or I've heard over the years, a number of issues that we will see a real sea change in once the generation that is under 35 now, once they are in the legislature they're, you know, voting more regularly. Do you see that's the day coming?
I mean, you know, with conversation, legislators will say one thing in public and say one thing privately, and they'll have a position and there's more nuance to it or anything. And without a doubt, it's undeniable that the Republicans have a strong influence in what legislation gets through. Just the same way the governor has enormous influence with what he can veto. So this idea that, you know, we don't need one party or the other, of course that's true. And that's one of the reasons why we undertook this 67-county county tour, but it put me in the middle of Perry County in a VFW, as red of a kind of backdrop, as red as a county as Pennsylvania has, and, you know, 55-60% of the room was for it. And it wasn't a controversial, like, burn the place kind of down kind of thing. So we made good faith efforts to demonstrate that we wanted to hear from the entire spectrum of, you know, we're smart enough to read an electoral map. We could say, where do we go to, if we wanted to, you know, fix, you know, like, hey, 90% of Pennsylvania wants this, you know, we would know where to go. But we went everywhere. And to anyone who was skeptical, I would say, you realize that 50 plus of 67 counties are red and didn't vote for Governor Wolf and I. And four out of the five conversations we had on this tour were in these places with these communities. And that's the emphasis, is that we wanted to hear from everybody. And that's, I think the takeaway is that this wasn't some kind of guided discovery. This was a true open-ended conversation with whoever wanted to participate.
When you file a report with Governor Wolf, will that be available to the public?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was paid for by the taxpayers. We kept our expenses well under $10,000. And we were committed to full transparency. You can see our invitation protocol, where, you know, we made one standard announcement. We didn't, you know, call up the local normal chapters, or, you know, push it hard on college campuses. Like I said, it was ironic. You know, when different people are mad at you, you know you're doing something right. People were frustrated. They're like, I didn't hear about this. I'm like, yeah, because we didn't promote it on a college campus. We wanted to have as scientific in an exact scientific process as something like this is, as much structure as we can.
Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, thank you for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's just always a pleasure.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Listen, tomorrow on Smart Talk, the Consul General of Canada will be here. We'll be talking about trade between Pennsylvania and Canada. And also, Alex Kershaw, author of the new book, The First Wave, The D-Day Warriors Who Led the Way to Victory in World War II. I'll have a conversation with him. You can visit our website to get an outlook of what the conversations we're working on are. Plus, you can leave a voicemail or voice memo question for one of our upcoming programs. More information is at WITF.org/SmartTalk. Pennsylvania is now part of the U.S. Climate Alliance, a coalition of states working to implement policies to uphold the U.S. commitments to reduce emissions that were part of the Paris Climate Accords. President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the agreement soon after taking office. As part of this effort, Pennsylvania has adopted a climate action plan. And in January, Governor Tom Wolf signed an executive order to set Pennsylvania's first statewide climate goals. Joining us to talk about all of this today is Patrick McDonald, Secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. Secretary McDonald, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Good to be back.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at @SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Pennsylvania now part of the U.S. Climate Alliance. What does being part of that alliance mean for the state?
Sure. So joining the Climate Alliance means a couple things. One, it's recognizing the commitment Governor Wolf made through his executive order to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 26% by 2025, 80% by 2050 in the Commonwealth. But it also puts us in touch with a number of other states in terms of the policies and types of things that they're pursuing. There's resources, there's connectivity between the states in terms of looking at issues like green banks, you know, financing mechanisms in order to accomplish the goals.
When you say other states, I believe the last number were 24 other states. It's over half the country if you look at population. Let me put it this way. I'll ask this question first. Is this a direct result of the U.S. pulling out of the Paris Climate Accords?
I think the Climate Alliance itself formed on that basis. But we as a state are again, very focused on this issue, whether it's dealing with climate change in terms of mitigation and adaptation strategies, or whether we're having conversations about flooding, conversations about future of agriculture, future of our state parks, health impacts. All of it's important, which is why making this kind of commitment is critical.
But would Pennsylvania have been this aggressive? And I say aggressive, it did take some time for Pennsylvania to become part of the alliance. Been this aggressive if the federal government had stayed part of the climate accords? I guess the reason I'm asking that question is because you know, there always will be people say it's not enough. The states just can't make that big of an impact. But then when you look at the other side, if we stayed in the Paris Accords, would the states have been aggressively trying to mitigate climate change?
I think we would have loved to have seen that kind of leadership at the federal level. The reality is exactly the things we're committing to are things the U.S. had previously committed to as part of the Paris Accord in a structure that was very, very flexible in terms of giving each country the ability to deal with the issue. It's definitely a lot better to deal with it as a nationwide issue. But in the absence of that, it's the most critical issue we face, as Governor Wolf has said repeatedly. The states have to lead on this.
Pennsylvania's new climate action plan. And I'll just read from your website. The plan describes over 100 actions, 15 of which DEP and partners analyzed quantitatively for potential greenhouse gas emissions reduction. The analysis showed that just those 15 actions, such as increasing renewable energy, incentivizing energy-efficient buildings, and increasing the use of electric vehicles, would reduce emissions 21% by 2025. Any combination of the 85 additional actions would likely achieve even more emission reductions. Those 85 other, I'm not going to ask you to name them all, but what are some of the big ones, the ones that could have a big impact on reducing greenhouse gases?
So we modeled the biggies, as was said. I think some of the other ones that were not modeled were some things in the transportation sector, for example. We did model, for example, reducing vehicle miles traveled, which has the advantage of not just reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but also is incredibly cheap to implement. There are some things, I believe, within the like biodiesel space, ethanol space, renewable fuel space that were not modeled within that. So that's one example on transportation. TCI, Transportation Climate Initiative, which we're part of, we're looking at policy options right now. So the ultimate modeling of that is just something that isn't possible as part of this as of yet. But that would be another example.
But when you say reducing vehicle miles, how does the state have an impact on that?
Well, I think that there's a couple things. One, you know, we obviously have the bully pulpit, so there's education. I think encouraging ride sharing, encouraging mass transit, all of these kinds of issues are critical ways to reduce vehicle miles traveled. I think just people being aware of what the impact is when you're in that car by yourself and you look over to the lane to your right and there's somebody there by themselves and you're all heading to the same place. There's a lot of impact that comes with that. So any actions we can take, bicycling, walking more, all of these kinds of things. Some of this gets into smart infrastructure in terms of sidewalks, in terms of bike lanes, things like that, that I know City of Harrisburg, for example, has looked at.
Overall, when I do know that there are municipalities that have taken this on. City of Lancaster, for example, you just gave some examples of City of Harrisburg. City of Lancaster has been lauded as a green city in some of the projects that they've undertaken. But overall, when planners are planning transportation projects, when they're planning a development, are they looking at climate change as one of the factors in those plans?
Increasingly, they are. as I said, you know, here in Harrisburg, we've had the bike lanes put in, and they've been looking at different ways of configuring traffic in order to allow it to flow a little better. Lancaster, you mentioned, as you said, a green city, and truly that, in that you'll see a lot of rooftop gardens, mm-hmm. a lot of stormwater mitigation projects, rain gardens throughout the city, things like that. That are green, but also allow you to deal with some of those impacts of climate change. One of the things we did in this year's plan for the first time was actually address adaptation to climate impacts on a going forward basis. So looking at, as we have increased flooding, how do we deal with that? How do we address it? Is one of the more important things that we're looking at.
I have to tell you that, you know, I looked at your website and there are some scary things there. I mean, you have some graphics talking about high-end and low-end predictions for temperature change over the next 30 years or so. Same with precipitation, same with flooding. And again, this isn't exact science. You can't say exactly how high the temperature is going to go up. But I guess the question I have is, do people realize this? I mean, I know we have a question coming up here from Melissa about education. Do people realize what we're talking about just on a statewide basis?
So I think that's one of the purposes of the plan and purposes of the number of efforts that we've had, whether it's been Finding Pennsylvania Solar Future, the electric vehicle roadmap, the plan, the executive order, joining the Climate Alliance, is to try to get that education out there. The reality is, and some of the way we characterize this is, you know, Philly and Pittsburgh start looking more like Richmond, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. going forward in terms
climate
of temperature.
Water. Okay.
Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of their climate, and that on the one hand doesn't, you know, it's a day trip down there, but on the other hand, it's a significant issue in terms of the types of plant species that they have, the length of growing seasons, and the types of things that you can grow there, the types of pests that you have to deal with within that. So it's an environmental impact, but it's also an economic impact if you're not addressing it well. It can be a positive economic impact if you are addressing it well.
We, WITF State Impact Pennsylvania reporter Marie Husick just filed a story yesterday about whether scientists know whether all the precipitation, the tornadoes we had last week in Pennsylvania, related to climate change. And basically the answer is we don't know right. for sure. But the precipitation that we have seen in this state over the past 9 months, over the past 10 months, is that what we're looking at on a regular basis?
When we were talking with the emergency management officials and some of their meteorologists, some of what they said is that they're concerned it's the new normal. And you mentioned the last 10 months. I mean, I've been in my 3 years as secretary, every year I've been in some part of the state dealing with significant flooding
in a lot
of cases. In
North
Central.
I just was talking about the amount of rain that we've gotten overall in the last year or so.
Well, not just the amount of rain, but the way it comes. So again, in that economic frame, the emergency management agency, we had 6 major storms last year, but a lot of them were very, very localized. So they didn't cross federal thresholds to get aid in the way some of the larger storms in the past. That's something that climate models have long predicted would happen, that we would see more of these high intensity rain events on a smaller, you know, in smaller areas. So, again, I always say, you know, past is prologue. We're starting to see exactly the things that the climate models bear out. Some of what we saw in the modeling was 10% increase in precipitation to date, another 8% increase coming between now and 2050. So that's what the modeling shows. We have no reason to distrust those models.
Let's take a phone call from Mike in Glen Rock. Mike, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
Besides some of the practical addressing ways to address climate change, like high-speed intercity rail or ethanol fugitive emissions and sprawl, what is the state planning with regards to educating the public with regards to basic climate change and the issues involved? I mean, there's a lot of smart people out there who also are people that love their families and care about life, but yet seem totally uninformed when it comes to climate change. So what is the state planning with regards to basic public information?
Thank you very much for your call, Mike.
Sure. So I'd say a couple of things. One is just as kind of at a base level, you mentioned our website. One of the things, in addition to releasing the plan, is we released what we call a story map that walks people through what the impacts of climate change are, why it's important in Pennsylvania, the kinds of things that we're going to see in terms of a higher tick population, for example, more mosquitoes carrying West Nile virus, those kinds of issues. So some of that level setting, there is some information there available about things people can do, but there's also information available in the Climate Action Plan about things that businesses and individuals can take on, be it, again, solar panels at the house, be it smarter stormwater management. All of those kinds of issues are things that we're trying to do a lot more active education on. The other piece I'd point out that I think is important that we're starting to focus on more is educating some of the municipalities about things that they can be doing, and not just, again, environmental impact, but economic impact for their municipality.
What about K-12 education?
That's something we actually now have a much better framework to focus on. The Department of Environmental Protection, Departments of Environmental Protection, Conservation, Natural Resources, Education, and Department of Agriculture are now funding some curriculum support for environmental education at the Department of Education. So we're getting more of the message out there through the Department of Education as well.
I have to admit that one of the reasons I asked that question is because we know there still are people who deny that climate change, the climate is changing, and may not be open to that being part of the curriculum. So I just wonder if there's any kind of political pushback on that.
Again, not that we've seen in terms of any specifics, I think I know, you know, I have four children, and they're certainly very tuned in, very aware, and not just because of me and my job, but are coming home from school with information about climate and doing their own critical thinking about it and evaluating things.
Let's take a call from Becky in Harrisburg. Becky, you're on the air.
Good morning, Scott and Secretary McConnell. The PennDOT agency is planning to do a lot of widening, specifically in the Harrisburg area, of I-83. And this is tremendously invasive, tremendously expensive, is only going to encourage more suburban sprawl. Is DEP able to do anything with its power over permits to make this not happen? And in addition, I would just like to put in a plug for last Tuesday's program on WIPF that made a very convincing case that like prime time pricing, charging people according to when they're driving to really have an effect, more so than any public transportation or other solutions. Sorry about the noise. That's my question.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. You know, the point that Becky brings up is one that you kind of have to wrestle with. We know there are more cars, more vehicles on the highways, mm-hmm. that they have to be maintained. You know, I-283, I know, is one that's being widened to three lanes in some areas. What she's talking about with I-83 and I-81, her point is it encourages more use of vehicles, but yet because those roads are there and people use them, it has to be done. So how do you weigh those two against each other?
I think it's exactly balancing those two things, right?
But
I'll say I think PennDOT's done a couple of things, and one I'll just say I don't think any of us have any authority over the congestion pricing kind of piece that she had mentioned at the end, but you know, we permit for water quality for these roadways. We are not looking at it from that element. I do know PennDOT has been looking at the impacts of their work through a climate change lens. And the two things I'd say are one, they're just looking at how they build their infrastructure, recognizing things are flooding, recognizing they're going to have more of these adaptation impacts. I think the second piece, and it's that balancing thing you talked about, is if you have a lot of cars sitting in traffic, that has a worse environmental impact than the smooth flow of that traffic as well. So it's a lot of things that need to happen together in terms of how we talk to municipalities about land use planning and what they're thinking about, and then what the infrastructure looks like to move people through that infrastructure.
What I'm hearing is there's no easy answer.
There's absolutely no easy answer. I mean, we have a lot of municipal governments in the state, and it's one of the strengths we have as a state is that local control. But it also means there's a lot of individual decisions that need to get made.
You see, what you just brought up, I think that makes the challenge even greater here in Pennsylvania, is because we do have so many municipalities, but not just municipalities. I mean, you're asking people to change their lifestyles, their habits. Pennsylvanians, Americans love their cars. You're asking people to change what they do. That's a tall order.
Absolutely, I'll say as a simple example on my end, I very, very much enjoy my less than 5 minute commute every day. I in my car for 12 minutes less.
What radio station you have on? WITF.
I'm usually listening to as a podcast.
Right. Okay,
I've shared that with you
before.
Just
want to make sure.
But the very, very quick and easy commute has its own advantages. Getting in, if I could take trains more, I would do that, enjoying that. So I think introducing people to some of these things. The other thing I'd say is the idea of a solar panel seemed very science fiction, just 10 years ago. And now it's hard to go three blocks in most places without seeing someone who has it on their rooftop. A lot of this stuff is being mainstreamed, and one of the things we say about a lot of these practices is the way to get more of the practices is to have more of the practices. The more people see it, the more they touch it, experience it, the more likely they are to participate.
We have a question from Kit who asks, is the state on board with Pennsylvania farmers? Carbon sequestration can be done from plantings of Christmas trees, crops, planting, etc. Can you address the no-till concepts and its effect on reducing carbon in the air?
Absolutely. That's one of the recommendations in the report. There's a fair bit that focuses on the agricultural sector, and it focuses on it, one, because no-till does lock carbon into soil. So we have an interest in that, and we're having some discussions now, for example, with through Department of Agriculture about looking at organic, which requires some tilling, and seeing if there's ways of doing organic through no-till as just an example. And then, as I said, we're going to have to start thinking about what do our crops look like going forward? What does pest management, invasive species look like going forward? What does it mean when you have a wetter growing season than you've typically had, and how do you manage some of those impacts?
Is there an invasive species out there right now that concerns you that could be in Pennsylvania soon?
What's
this tiger mosquito thing?
The Asian tiger mosquito has been here for some time. We've seen that in all 67 counties. It's a carrier of the West Nile virus. That is something we have in all 67 counties. Some of the concern, though, becomes as we see that lengthening of the season for propagation of the insect.
Yeah. Secretary McDonald, we only have a minute left, and there's so much to talk about. But message that you'd like to—I mean, obviously, you wanted to come on the program and talk about what the state is doing. What message would you like to leave with people?
I would like to—I think the question you got about education is the critical one. So I'd encourage all your listeners, go to our website, go through the story map to get some of those basic facts, explore the Climate Change Action Plan. There's an executive summary if you don't want to dive into the 200 plus pages of it, and just educate yourself about the kinds of things you can do and the kind of impacts that this is having on the Commonwealth today and going forward.
quickly, because I only have about 20 seconds. I know there are people listening and say, well, what kind of economic impact will this have?
So some of what we modeled in the report was 6,500 jobs between now and 2025 in terms of improvement, and up to 40,000 new jobs supporting climate change reduction and adaptation by 2050.
Pennsylvania Secretary of the Department of Environmental Protection, Patrick McDonald, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, the Consul General of Canada will be with us. Also, Alex Kershaw, author of the new book, The First Wave, The D-Day Warriors, who led the way to victory in World War II. Of course, Thursday is the 75th anniversary of D-Day. We will be in Gettysburg at the Eisenhower Historic Site for the 75th anniversary of D-Day.